Iran's leader says that the domestic economy must not be tied to U.S. sanctions, reiterating that the policies of the country prove that progress can be made despite the sanctions. The Yemeni army releases details of its latest retaliatory operations against Saudi Arabia and the kingdom's allies, dubbed the breaking of the siege. In day 26 of Russia-Ukraine conflict, Kiev announces a deal on 8 humanitarian corridors from the besieged areas, but the port city of Mariupol is not among them. This is news. Thanks for joining us. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has just addressed the nation on the occasion of the Persian New Year. The leader said the economy is a key issue and has called on officials to increase efforts to make it stronger. Ayatollah Khamenei added that as far as the economy is concerned, national production is the most important factor. The leader noted that Iran should definitely move toward a knowledge-based economy and stressed that it should not be tied to U.S. sanctions. He said despite those sanctions, Iran can make progress, and the Iranian companies have already proven this issue. That, however, Ayatollah Khamenei said, does not mean that Tehran should not seek the removal of the sanctions. He explained that the country should be run in a way that restrictions cannot harm its economy. The Yemeni army has released details of its retaliatory attacks, including the latest operations dubbed Breaking the Siege. Those attacks have hit targets in Saudi Arabia and its allied countries in the ongoing war in Yemen over the past 7 years.
The Yemen hurricane was also launched, and the break of the siege operations were also launched. The total of sum of killed and wounded of the enemy, 275,143 wounded or killed from human casualties, the Saudi 10,759, the Emiratis 1,251, the Sudanese 9,440, and the mercenaries that were also the Yemeni mercenaries and Yemeni traitors, 253,693.
Yahya Sari said the Yemeni people have remained resilient and steadfast in the face of the Saudi war over the past 7 years. He said that the Yemenis are capable of defending the sovereignty of their country in the face of any acts of aggression. Sari said the army will continue its retaliatory operations until the Saudi-led war stops. The war began in March 2015. Saudi Arabia and its allies also imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen. The blockade, coupled with daily airstrikes, has worsened the humanitarian situation, where tens of thousands have died as a result.
The spokesman for Yemen's armed forces, Brigadier General Yahya Sari, says Sana'a has staged a fresh retaliatory operation against the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in a bid to break the all-out blockade Riyadh has imposed on its southern neighbor. Yahya Sari noted that targets in Saudi Arabia's port city of Jeddah, as well as Jizan, have been struck in the third phase of special operations. Earlier, Sari announced the second phase, saying Yemeni forces had conducted major operations, which he described as special in nature, and that the mission had been carried out successfully. He pointed out the large-scale operation has been staged with a batch of ballistic missiles and drones. According to the spokesman, Phase 2 involved projectiles flying across the border, targeting a number of vital and sensitive sites in the regions of Abha, Khamis Umshayyad, Jizan, and Samata, as well as southern Tehran, with facilities belonging to Saudi oil giant Aramco among the sites targeted. Saudi state media acknowledged a barrage of drone and missile attacks. Despite the kingdom claiming to have intercepted the projectiles, it later reported that drones had hit a petroleum distribution terminal, a natural gas plant, and an oil refinery that led to a temporary reduction in the refinery's production levels. On March 11, Sari announced the first phase of this operation, which also included the bombing of a number of vital and sensitive Saudi facilities affiliated with Aramco in Riyadh, among other areas. He has stressed that the operations come within the framework of Yemen's legitimate right to respond to what he labeled as an unjust siege. According to UN experts, the Saudi-led blockade on Yemen is having a catastrophic effect on millions of people.
The Yemenis have suffered a lot because they cannot import even food or medicine. And the past 70 years have been hell to the Yemenis. And it is now seven painful years for them, and the world is just watching.
Saria has pledged that the Yemeni armed forces will carry out more military operations in the not-so-distant future to break the siege, warning Riyadh the upcoming retaliatory attacks will include sensitive targets that are beyond the imagination of the Saudis.
Just recently, multiple United Nations agencies sounded the alarm over the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, warning that it is only going to get worse. According to the UN, today more than 17.4 million Yemenis are food insecure. This is while famine is expected to increase fivefold by 2023, pushing half of all children under five into malnutrition.
The Saudi war in Yemen is on the brink of its seventh anniversary. On March 26, 2015, Riyadh and a number of its regional allies, backed by the United States, declared war on Yemen. Riyadh said the offensive would take a couple of weeks to achieve its goals, one of which was to restore the former government in Sana'a, whose term had expired but was loyal to the Saudis. However, 7 years later, analysts say the kingdom and its allies, including Washington, have underestimated the determination and the steadfastness of the Yemeni forces and nation to seek sovereignty from Saudi rule. In normal warfare, Saudi Arabia would have the upper hand in this war. Riyadh enjoys unwavering support from the West, in particular the United States. Washington has provided logistical and intelligence backing to the Saudi Air Force, while the UK has trained Saudi pilots. But the real support has come in the form of arms sales. America and its Western allies have sold the Saudis advanced weapons to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars, making a massive profit. Despite warnings by rights groups of Western complicity in war crimes amid an indiscriminate Saudi bombardment campaign that has killed women and children, Western weapons continue to flow into the kingdom. Despite all this support, the question is, after 7 years, why can't Saudi Arabia win its war on Yemen?
They do not have legitimate goals by waging the war. Number two, their people, their soldiers have become demoralized because of their inability to score victories over the Yemenis. And thirdly, the Yemenis are known historically for their power.
Under a tight blockade, Yemeni forces have manufactured their own indigenous ballistic missiles and drones. Despite their relatively low costs in comparison with Saudi weapons, they have proven very effective. Yemeni officials say they have no choice but to expand retaliatory operations against targets deep inside Saudi Arabia, with the goal of forcing Riyadh to end its blockade and to end its air raids.
The U.S. has transferred a significant number of Patriot missile interceptors to Saudi Arabia in recent weeks. That's to help the kingdom against retaliatory attacks from Yemen. A senior U.S. administration official says the decision is in line with President Joe Biden's promise that Washington will have the backs of his friends in the region. Earlier this year, Riyadh requested for a resupply of interceptor missiles for its U.S.-made Patriot batteries. The supply of them comes despite the fact that Biden had promised to end the U.S. support for the Saudi war in Yemen. The Russian military operation in Ukraine is in its 26th day. Ukrainian authorities say both sides have agreed to create 8 humanitarian corridors to evacuate civilians from besieged towns and cities. Deputy Prime Minister Irina Vereshchuk says the agreement does not cover Mariupol. She added that efforts to reach the volatile city with humanitarian supplies have led nowhere. Moscow has set a deadline for Kyiv to surrender the city. Russia has also promised safe passage to Ukrainian nationalists in Mariupol, provided that they lay down their arms. Kyiv, however, has rejected Russia's demands. It says giving up the city is out of the question. Russia also keeps pounding other parts of Ukraine. At least 6 people were killed in overnight bombing in the capital, Kyiv. The city's mayor says shelling has hit residential homes and a shopping district. The Russian military also hit a Ukrainian army facility in Rivne region with cruise missiles. We have talked to our correspondent Rob Carter, who is currently in the Polish city of Lublin. He has told us about the refugee crisis caused by the Russia-Ukraine conflict.
Well, as it was predicted by many, more than 2 million Ukrainians have now entered into Poland. So that's the single biggest number of refugees that one country has taken in so far. And obviously it's put tremendous strain on Poland, but there is a massive effort here to cater for all of these new guests, and that effort is still underway. But as for the situation, obviously the fighting is still ongoing, and the more fighting that occurs and the more that the situation in Ukraine escalates, the greater the refugee crisis will inevitably be, as there are still, I believe, somewhere about 6.5 million Ukrainians that are actually displaced inside Ukraine, mostly moving over to the western part of Ukraine, which hasn't been so heavily hit by the military operations. That, of course, if it does expand, then, of course, those refugees might decide, you know what, we actually want to get out of Ukraine completely and flee either towards the west, or more refugees could indeed flee actually into Russia itself from the eastern part as well.
The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky renews his plea for talks with his Russian counterpart, saying negotiations are the only way to end the war.
I am ready for negotiations with him. I was ready over the last 2 years. And I think that without negotiations, we cannot end this war.
Zelensky noted that if there is a, quote, just 1% chance to stop the war, we need to take this opportunity to talk to the Russian president. In an exclusive interview with CNN, the Ukrainian president also warned of a possibility of a third world war if such attempts fail. He blamed Russian forces for what he called exterminating and killing Ukrainians. Zelensky's call for talks comes amid accusations that Russia is committing war crimes in Ukraine. An oil embargo on Russia over its military campaign in Ukraine tops the agenda of the talks between the European Union governments and their allies later this week. The senior EU diplomat says this is part of a new round of sanctions that the bloc is preparing against Moscow. They will be discussed during the upcoming summits of NATO and the group of 7 major economies. The US and the UK have already targeted the Russian oil, but EU countries are yet to agree on similar measures amid calls for caution by some, including Germany and Bulgaria. France, which holds the rotating presidency of the EU Council, however, says that there should be no taboos if the situation in Ukraine worsens. Moscow has reacted, warning that such an embargo will hit everyone. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Brussels, Jerome Hughes, to get more details about this week's summits and potential European sanctions against Russia in the energy sector.
There will be a couple of big summits at least this week. Later on in the week, we'll have a NATO summit, but also EU leaders will meet here in Brussels. And what's happening today is you have like a series of meetings. At one point, you will have 3 sets of ministers from the EU meeting at the same time together, and that would be the EU foreign ministers, EU defense ministers, and EU affairs ministers. And they're basically meeting to lay the groundwork for decisions that will be taken by the 27 heads of government when they meet at the summit on Thursday here. And Josep Borrell, he's the EU's foreign policy chief, and very just within the past hour, he entered the meeting to sort of chair the foreign affairs element to it as well. And he talked about the fact that, you know, he made the claim that Russia is committing massive war crimes, to quote him. And he was speaking specifically in relation to what's happening in Mariupol. So, he said it's going to be a very long day. There's a lot of things on the agenda. But as you mentioned, one of the key items is to prepare for possible new sanctions in the area of energy. And this is very, very significant because, as we know, In the EU, we get 27% of our oil and 40% of our gas from Russia. And it's reciprocally, it's a very important agreement that's been going on for years. I mean, Russia makes huge money from supplying this energy. There's no doubt about that. But at the same time, the EU is very dependent. It's a very massive element to keeping the EU's economy afloat, is to have this sort of cheap gas coming in particular. But also, I mean, I think that's why they're talking about oil, because if they put some sort of restrictions on imports of oil into the EU, it would have a less damaging effect on the EU itself. But it opens up the question of how Russia might respond.
Political commentator Matus Piskorski says an oil embargo by the European Union on Russia will backfire on the bloc.
You can easily notice that all what has happened in Ukraine during the last month has affected first and foremost the countries of Central Europe. Then secondly, it has already affected strong economies like the German economy. And by the way, if you look at Germany's role in European Union, and it would any kind of new embargo against the Russian import of Russian oil would affect first and foremost the German economy. So one might think that the Germans will lose on that. But actually, if you see at the role of Germany as practically the only industrial country of European Union and the only economic superpower of European Union nowadays, then you would notice that Germany is so heavily interconnected, its economy is so heavily interconnected with Central European countries, with some even Western European countries, that a small crisis in Germany, which could be a result of the new sanctions, will affect definitely the whole European Union.
And that is for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Congratulations to everyone at the start of spring and revival of nature. Happy Iranian New Year!
In the limelight.
Every day, more than 1,000 Americans are still dying of COVID, says Stephen Harper Ryder in an article published under the heading, The Expendable Americans in a Pandemic. Stay tuned for more. On March 14, 2022, 7 million Americans and their families became victims again. For the first time since the COVID pandemic began, Republicans jettisoned Congress's bipartisan approach of providing no-strings emergency funds to the battle of the virus. Instead, the GOP insisted that Democrats find a way to pay for ongoing COVID testing, treatment, and vaccines. Otherwise, Republicans would scuttle the $1.5 trillion omnibus bill funding the entire federal government through September. The bill also included a $42 billion increase in military spending and almost $14 billion in emergency aid for the military. According to a study published in JAMA Network on December 28, 2021, the vulnerable American population is at increased risk of breakthrough COVID-19 infection that can have severe and even fatal outcomes. The COVID funds were a rounding error. A $15.6 billion item, or 1% of the omnibus bill, to assuage Republicans, Democrats pulled $7 billion from state aid allocated in a previous relief package. But pushback from governors and some House Democrats caused Speaker Nancy Pelosi to remove COVID funding from the bill altogether. The number two Republican in the Senate, John Thune, tried to blame Democrats. He said, "We had a chance to get that last week and the House progressive wing blew it up. They torpedoed it." Given the GOP's new demand that Democrats find a way to pay for this round of COVID plan, that's nonsense. For immunocompromised citizens, like many Americans, vaccination offers some protection, but the science is clear. According to a study published in JAMA Network on December 28, 2021, the vulnerable American population is at increased risk of breakthrough COVID-19 infection that can have severe and even fatal outcomes. Individuals 65 and over account for 75% of all deaths. Likewise, across all age ranges, more than 7 million American adults live with compromised immune systems that impede vaccine effectiveness. In a recent study, vaccinated immunosuppressed patients accounted for 44% of breakthrough hospitalizations, and an even greater percentage, about 98%, were over 50, which makes Americans a double dipper in the COVID pool. In his State of the Union message, President Biden said, "We're leaving no one behind or ignoring anyone's needs as we move forward." He then outlined his plan for stockpiles of tests, masks, pills, if Congress provides the funds they needed. Well, Congress dropped that ball, but the Biden administration and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention share some of the blame for the current plight in the United States of America. As of last summer, COVID had killed 580,000 Americans, but Biden said the worst was over. The CDC announced that anyone vaccinated didn't need to wear a mask indoors or outdoors. When Delta arrived, infections and hospitalizations soared, but most people remained in an "I've moved on, I'm so done with COVID" state of denial. As Omicron engulfed the world and swamped hospitals yet again, that mindset persisted. America paid the price for its denialism. By January 2022, the country was approaching 1 million COVID deaths, and the CDC told everyone to wear N95 masks for the best protection against Omicron. A month later, the CDC revised its metrics to focus on hospital admissions rather than infections. Using the new criteria, most of the country went from high community transmission levels to medium or low levels overnight, and suddenly 70% of Americans could remove their masks. But every day, more than 1,000 Americans are still dying of COVID. Now, rising infection and hospitalization rates in Europe provide troubling signs that another wave may be underway. As Dr. Eric Topel recently wrote, that in itself requires preparedness. Unfortunately, we have a mindset that the pandemic is over, which couldn't be further than the truth. Now, we have a new perspective on how handicapped individuals must have felt before the Americans with Disabilities Act became law. The COVID fate remains in the hands of people motivated to look the other way. Americans have become an unwanted footnote in discussions about transitioning the country from pandemic, which is where they still are, to so-called endemic, a goal for which they have no real pain or plan. Lip service about leaving no one behind has yielded to social Darwinism, making 7 million people like anyone in the United States expendable. The country shouldn't come to a screeching halt because some of Americans have compromised immune systems that make COVID especially dangerous. But presenting that as the only alternative to moving on, the message that people embrace because they want to hear is disingenuous. Rather than promoting magical thinking, the U.S. officials should tell Americans the truth. Just because you haven't contracted severe COVID doesn't mean that the pandemic is over. Just because you don't have symptoms doesn't mean that you can't transmit the virus to someone who will develop serious complications with tragic consequences. Rather than sowing doubt about scientific facts, provide funds for testing, treatment, and vaccines, all of which are now in imminent jeopardy. Adopting those public health measures should be characterized as bipartisan victories. They will not only better protect the most vulnerable now, but also help everyone defeat future lethal variants. Helping Americans, the immunocompromised, helps everyone in the world.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Wassalatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing the topic of the Charter of Islamic Covenants based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are focusing on the first sermon, in parts of the first sermon, where Imam Ali alayhi salam explains the revolutionary nature of the Holy Quran, that the Quran contains these general principles that can always be referred to in the path of change, in the path of growth, and reaching the direction that is required by the Islamic Ummah. That means that the Quran needs to be a book that can be understood by all. It's a book that needs to be referable by everyone. Of course, that doesn't mean that it doesn't require a teacher and a guide, because not all the verses are clear, not all the verses have a clear meaning, and sometimes the verses explain other verses, or certain statements of the Imams or the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam explain the verses, and some details have not come. So all of these mean that there is a requirement of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasallam. Yet we need to have that balanced approach. And we've been discussing about this balanced approach for some time, until we reached this discussion where we said that this thought of limiting the Quran just to reading and all that, This is something that was, something inherited from very wrong people, very wrong understandings, and therefore we need to avoid this type of thinking.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, there is another argument that we can pose to the people who say that you cannot make use and understand even one verse of the Quran without narrations, without the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. The argument is like this, that if you look at those books of exegesis or the books of tafsir that have riwayat or the narrations quoted, or we can say they are tafsir riwayi, they are tafsirs that are based on narrations. So a verse is brought and then certain narrations that are under or related to that verse are brought. If you look at these tafsir, for example, tafsir Nur al-Thaqalain or tafsir Burhan or similar other tafsir, we'll notice that only a few verses of the Quran have got narrations explaining them. A majority of the verses of the Quran, at least two-thirds of the verses of the Quran, do not have narrations specifically speaking about those verses or explaining those verses. In other words, these people would be saying that, majority of the Quran is useless, is not understandable. It's like when you read it, it's like you have a blank information inside your mind. That would be absolutely wrong to say. It would be against the wisdom of God to be able to create such a system whereby the Quran is there but it's not understood by the people unless and until they have riwayat. And the problem is that riwayat are not there in such high numbers. So it's as if these people are telling us that, you know, you can just take those verses and you might not understand the meaning. It doesn't matter. Like, you know, you'll remain blank. Which is absolutely against God's wisdom and against the logic and intellect. And therefore, definitely this argument means that we are able to understand certain verses, majority of the verses of the Quran, in fact. But, yes, the Quran needs, certain places needs explanation, certain areas need depth. And all of that comes from the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Another argument that can be posed is that if you're saying that the verses of the Quran sometimes cannot be understood, then how sure are you that the narrations are all understood? Because they are both in Arabic. If you are not able to understand, you're saying that the Quran is a book that cannot be understood. So majority of the times, the narrations also cannot be understood because they are in the same language. Sometimes they speak in the same manner. So you are trying to say that the Quran can be understood, cannot be understood, but the narrations can be understood. Under what basis? So we notice that both of these need each other. The narrations need the Quran because the Quran is the basis through which all these narrations have come. The Quran also needs the narrations because these narrations of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam explain those verses at depth, flesh, you know, and you know, different. They give perspective to that verse of the Quran. This unfortunately is the result of those enemies of the Quran. Enemies of the religion of God who want to seclude the Quran in a corner and leave and separate Islam from the Quran. This is something that needs to be very, very carefully looked into. understood properly. Yes, you know, sometimes what happens is that people tend to, accept things that look simple and, you know, easy to understand, and they feel that, you know, this is something that we can accept quickly. But, you know, life is not always about taking things easy. Sometimes you need to be able to give depth to your thinking and the way you decide about how to make use of your religion and how you're able to interact with the religious information that is there around you. And when you use that aspect, you realize that the Quran itself has got all of these verses that are inviting us all towards pondering, and all these arguments come to your mind, and of course you make a decision regarding what your viewpoint is. Inshallah, we pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that we are able to understand the Quran properly, and we are able to use the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam to give us depth and strength in understanding the Quran properly. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
مرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد مجيد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
Public outrage is building. The court's approval rating is now around 40%. Congress needs to act before an entire branch of government sinks into an irredeemable Trump-fueled muck of corruption, says Tom Hartman, author, in an article published under the heading, Let's Just Say It Very Clearly. The U.S. Supreme Court is corrupt. Here's the story. so now, as expected after decades of taking big bucks for her right-wing work on behalf of all America's oligarch, we learned that the wife of Supreme Court Associate Justice Clarence Thomas, Jeannie Thomas, was in Trump's January 6th rally up to her eyeballs. Let's just say it right out loud. The Supreme Court of the United States of America is corrupt, and Americans know it very well. No other federal court in the U.S. would allow a defendant in a case before them to fly a judge on a private Gulfstream luxury jet to a luxury hunting retreat in Louisiana and then a week later watch as that judge rules in that defendant's favor. But Supreme Court Justice Antoine Scalia did exactly that when Dick Cheney was sued for allegedly lying about his secret energy group that was planning the seizure and sale of Iraq's oil fields, as he and Bush lied Americans into the war that opened those oil fields up to exploitation. No other federal court would allow a judge to give a speech before a group that was funding a case before them and then rule in favor of that group's openly stated goal. But that's exactly when Neil Gorsuch did, when he addressed the Fund for American Studies, itself funded by the Bradley Foundation that was helping fund by Janus versus AFS CME case that gutted union protections for government workers. No other federal court would allow a judge to sue revenge against a particular nonprofit corporation, in this case, the Democratic Party, saying in his confirmation hearing that what goes around comes around, and then rule in cases directly affecting that organization like voting rights. But Brett Bierbaum Kavanaugh did just that. No other federal court would allow a judge to rule on a case where he owned $500,000 worth of stock in the company presenting amicus arguments before the court. It's illegal in many states, but John Roberts did just that in ABC versus Aereo case, as did Roberts, Breyer, and Alito in 25 of 37 other cases where they owned stock, according to the Good Government Group Fix the Court. No other federal court would allow a judge's wife to openly interact with and advocate for the interests of dozens of litigants before the court over decades and take nearly $1 million from a group regularly helping bring cases before his court. But Clarence Thomas and his wife have done both, as recently revealed in a shocking New York Times profile. And now the court is on the verge of gutting the EPA, the agency Justice Gorsuch's mother infamously ran into the ground before resigning in disgrace during Reagan administration, using Gorsuch's own BS textualist rationale to go after the agency today. In addition, these Republican appointees are openly shooting down Democratic efforts to fight gerrymandered maps while supporting GOP efforts to impose them on states. Is there no way to paraphrase Shakespeare to rid ourselves of this court's corrupt behavior? Turns out Congress has that power, although they haven't used it since Ulysses Grant was president and reorganized the court. Article 3rd of the Constitution establishes the federal court system and gives to Congress itself the power to create the lower federal courts. It also says that the Supreme Court judges may only serve on the court if they behave themselves. It also requires Congress to regulate the Supreme Court. Article 3rd, Section 2 says the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction both as to law and fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make. The issue of Supreme Court needing regulation from the first among equals legislative branch, Congress, as specified by the founders and framers of the Constitutions, has been with us for 121 years. Most people remember William Howard Taft as the one-term progressive Republican president who followed Teddy Roosevelt into the White House in 1909 and was beaten for re-election by Woodrow Wilson in 1912. But after his retirement from the presidency, Taft became the first former president to serve as Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court in 1921. He was the 27th president and 10th Chief Justice of the U.S. In 1921, it came to the attention of the nation and to Chief Justice Taft that U.S. District Judge Landis was taking five times his annual salary as a judge from what was then called organized baseball 5 years after ruling in their favor. The scandal provoked Congress to pass in 1922 a law creating a body that would provide advice and oversight to the federal judiciary. It came to be known as the Judicial Conference of the United States. The scandal also prompted Chief Justice Taft to accept the unpaid chairmanship of the American Bar Association, newly formed commission to write ethics rules for federal judges. Taft's commission wrote in 1923 the first canons of judicial ethics, which included 34 categories of judicial conflicts and misbehavior that would either disqualify a judge or require their recusal from cases before them. They included conflicts of interest, personal, financial investments, and even behavior in the courtroom itself. Taft, in delivering the canons, made it clear they should apply to all federal courts, including his own Supreme Court. Within a decade, every state in the Union had adopted the canons for their own courts. The canons, however, had no enforcement mechanism, particularly when it comes to the Supreme Court. After all, who would judge the highest court in the land? That opened the door for literally a century of the Supreme Court ignoring Taft work. The issue came to the fore again in 1969 when Republicans went nuts when it was revealed that Justice Abe Fortas, a very liberal, Republicans call him a communist, LBJ appointee, had taken $15,000 for a summer teaching post, was receiving time-delayed payments from a law former client, and worst of all, was secretly advising President Johnson. Under massive incoming fire from Republicans and their friendly media, Fortas resigned from the Supreme Court on May 14, 1969. Over the next 3 years, the ABA put together a new commission to update Taft's original canon on judicial ethics. That commission released their new code of judicial conduct in 1972, and it was adopted by the Judicial Conference of the United States in 1973. The Supreme Court, however, chose to ignore it, arguing that they were above such considerations. By that time, the Supreme Court had made itself, as we lay out in detail in the hidden history of the Supreme Court and the betrayal of America, the most powerful of the three branches of government, asserting power to second-guess both Congress and the president. Ironically, in his 2011 annual report about the state of the judiciary, Chief Justice John Roberts made lengthy and effusive reference to former Chief Justice Taft and his work with the ABA's Commission on Judicial Ethics. His report, however, conveniently omitted the fact that Taft had loudly and publicly asserted it should apply to the Supreme Court. Instead, Roberts noted rhetorically, "Some observers have recently questioned whether the Judicial Conference's code of conduct for United States judges should apply to the Supreme Court." We will spare you extended quotes from Roberts' report, which you can read it later, but the bottom line is that, in his opinion, the court can tell the 1923 ethics recommendations and the subsequent ones from 1973 to go screw themselves. The Supreme Court, in his mind, is answerable to nobody but itself. As Sam Alito said, I'm not aware of problems on the Supreme Court itself. We would not sit back. We would take action that's appropriate. Most recently, Senator Chris Murphy introduced the Supreme Court Ethics Act that would seek to regulate the court out of control politicking and conflicts of interest. Predictably, it was blocked by Republicans in the Senate. Public outrage is building. The court's approval rating is now around 40%, a historic low. Congress needs to act, requiring them to adopt and conform to the Federal Code of Judicial Ethics at the very least, and expand the court at best, before an entire branch of government sinks into an irredeemable partisan muck of corruption.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website www.parstoday.com/EM.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, Hadith of the Day, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a very noble tradition narrated from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. And this tradition is about something that will occur in the hereafter. As you know, when we die, God Almighty will send some angels to us to ask us about certain things. In this tradition, the Imam indicates some of the things that a man will be asked about, and he also points to, coincidentally, the first thing that a man will be asked about, a human being will be asked about in the hereafter. Imam Sadiq says, the first thing that man will be asked about when he stands before Allah, exalted be his grandeur, is the obligatory prayers, salat. He will be asked about if he performed his prayers. The obligatory alms tax, the zakat. The third is the obligatory fasting. Did he fast or not? The obligatory pilgrimage, the hajj. If he had the means to perform them, did he perform it or not? And finally, the Imam says, and our guardianship, wilayat, the people of the household of the Prophet. So the person will also be asked about the wilayat or the guardianship of the Ahlul Bayt, the family of the Prophet. Did he accept it? Does he accept it? Does he believe in it? Did he act upon its dictates? Did he follow the Imams or not? In continuation, Imam Sadiq says, if he attests to our guardianship and dies believing that, right? So if he